Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED Public Radio and your moderator for today's program. This afternoon's program is part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. This program is also being held in association with the San Francisco State University Alumni Association, Department of Journalism. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss. Mr. Moss has been a reporter with the Investigations Group of the New York Times since 2000. Before coming to the Times, Mr. Moss was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, New York Newsday, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Daily Sentinel in Grand Junction, Colorado, and High Country News in Lander, Wyoming. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for his reporting on hamburger and other food safety lapses. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer in 2006 for his reporting on the lack of protective armor for soldiers and Marines in Iraq, and in 1999 for a team effort on forced evictions and other Wall Street influences in the nursing home industry. The Overseas Press Club awarded him a citation in 2007 for stories on the faulty justice system for American-held detainees in Iraq. Mr. Moss is the author of Palace Coup, the inside story of Harry and Leona Helmsley. And I'm sure he'll tell us about Leona's dog at some point, maybe later today. So please welcome Mr. Moss.
Thank you so much for being here, especially on a gorgeous day like this. I always hate it when it's nice here in San Francisco because it makes me homesick. I was actually born in Eureka during a flood that kept my grandmother from being on time for the birthing, as I recall, but I am a sun person. And every time I come visit here, I hope for fog and always get sun. My education in meat and E. coli began in a Seattle supermarket, actually, when a source took me shopping. And instead of just picking up the package of hamburger, he used those plastic bags from the produce section as gloves to keep any pathogens off his hands and our shopping cart. Then I spoke with another source, and he told me how he uses rubbing alcohol or even diluted bleach to sanitize his kitchen after cooking with hamburger. And finally, I had lunch with a third source who ordered his burger well done. And when it came out, to his satisfaction, like shoe leather, he was a happy camper. These sources were not consumer activists. All three were top experts on meat who work for the meat industry. One was even a lobbyist. And they take these precautions because their insider status has made them knowledgeable about risks in meat that most of us think were solved a century ago when the federal government responded to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. How did we get to a place where grocery shopping requires rolling the dice? And not just for bacteria in meats and vegetables, which each year sicken tens of millions of people. I've recently done some reporting on excessive salt in processed foods, which kills an estimated 100,000 people every year. One of the most startling things I've learned is that regulators fear that if they push too hard on food companies to reduce the added salt, companies will increase the sugar and fat in their products to make up for the lost allure of the salt. And how did we get to a place where cooking that iconic of American meals, the hamburger, requires the discipline of a science project? Your package of hamburger, whether fresh or frozen, will have the requisite stamp of approval from the USDA. But if you read the fine print, you'll learn that you must cook the meat to 160 degrees in order to kill any pathogens that might be lurking inside. The agency and the industry calls this the kill step, and it isn't easy to accomplish. It doesn't just work to check to see that the meat inside the hamburger has turned brown, because it turns brown at a lower temperature that won't kill the pathogens. Instead, you have to use a thermometer. and the right thermometer. You need one that picks up the temperature just at the tip, not the entire shaft of the thermometer. And you have to use it judiciously, poking it in the burger in several places to account for uneven cooking. In my own Brooklyn backyard, any effort to properly conduct this kill step is competing with the beer in my left hand, the ball flying overhead tossed by my two boys, you know, the guest telling an engaging story. For Stephanie Smith, the 23-year-old former dance instructor who was left paralyzed by E. coli, the flaw in the science project that became her Sunday dinner might have been the onions that started to burn on the stove inside the house, says her mom, who's a professional cook, by the way. She'd prepared the meal, but the burger singed a little bit on the grill while she tended the onions, and some of her own friends blamed her for taking the burgers off too soon. But Stephanie needn't have eaten the burger to have fallen ill. E. coli is so powerful that only a few cells can make you sick. And cross-contamination to kitchen surfaces and to other foods is an added risk. Let's be clear on what the risk is here, or try to be clear. Most illness from E. coli resolves itself without major complications like Stephanie ran into. The meat industry has said that E. coli might be found in 1 in 150 samples of hamburger. Citing some recent testing by the Department of Agriculture, the agency discourages people from making this calculation because these days it is sampling so few grocery stores that those data are statistically uncertain. It could be higher, it could be lower, but let's say it's right. Let's say it's 1 in 150. You know, a family of four using lots of ground chuck to make their food budget stretch could hit that mark before a year's end. The number of outbreaks of illness from E. coli in hamburger began spiking 3 years ago. And there's a few theories out there as to what might be the root cause. One of the more interesting guesses is that raids by immigration authorities caused a talent drain in the slaughterhouse, where workers need lots of experience, months and months, in wielding a knife in order to avoid contaminating the meat with E. coli. But I think there may be some other issues at play here that I'd love to talk about with you. The increasingly global race by food companies for cheaper ingredients that are harder to safeguard. The collectively shrinking newsroom in America that has less and less resource to cover subjects like food safety. Our own sense of entitlement that food should be cheap and plentiful, and our increasing disconnect from knowing where it comes from. I see some signs of hope in all three of these matters. Let's start with the race for cheaper ingredients. The peanuts that killed 8 people and sickened 19,000 others in 43 states last year came from a processing plant in Georgia that was buying second-grade nuts from Latin America, where the rigor of government inspection is generally lower than here in the U.S. But the nuts were used so widely by food manufacturers in the U.S. that it took many weeks to accomplish the recall. Many of those companies had no idea where they were buying the peanuts that went into their various products. And many of those companies didn't know they were using this particular plant's nuts. But they did know the price. And food companies are increasingly reaching overseas for lower-cost ingredients that can keep their product prices down. Infrequent and inexpert inspections of the peanut plant by both government and private auditors certainly contributed to that outbreak. As for the dwindling watchdog media, my own personal experience tells some of the grim story out there. I used to work for a New York paper called Newsday until it closed its New York City edition. Then I worked for the Wall Street Journal, which is now owned by Rupert Murdoch, who has his own unique view of what makes good journalism. One of the more moving responses I received when the hamburger articles ran last year were from fellow reporters who'd been laid off and had no hope of re-entering the business. They wanted to give me their notes for stories that they didn't have time to finish in hope that their work might not simply disappear. I focused on meat last year, but pathogens don't discriminate. Vegetables, spices, even flour can carry salmonella. or E. coli, and the grocery's freezer aisle is no safe haven, since these bacteria can survive being frozen. As the ingredient chain is stretched, so is the chain of dependency for safety checks. In the case of the peanuts, the consumer was relying on the food manufacturer, who was relying on government or private auditors, who were relying on the peanut processors and often various middlemen, who were relying on farmers in Latin America and whatever government regulatory framework there is there. And there were some really weak links. Going back to the media, I've specialized in investigative reporting for half of my 30 years as a reporter, and I've reported in difficult places like Fallujah and other war zones in Iraq and the Middle East. But running down food safety stories is in many ways just as challenging, and I'm usually in awe of health and food beat reporters who are trying to do this day in and day out. In response to outbreaks, the U.S. government releases the most minimal information. It then further shields the food companies by refusing to release many of the details about their food safety plans, even in documents that reporters obtain through the time-consuming Freedom of Information Act. And finally, there's us, the consumers. Who doesn't shop for food based on the price? And how can we totally blame the company that made Stephanie's burger when it's under tremendous price pressure from supermarkets and food retailers to keep its meat cheap? Pressure so great that just a few pennies will make or break a sales contract for them. So now for the hopeful signs. Some food companies are going well beyond what the federal government requires on food safety. And one of these exceptions I found in my reporting the hamburger stories is Costco, the retail giant that supports its operations with membership fees. It took me a while to realize how this structure affects its view on food safety, but the fees help insulate the company from financial pressures that cause some other companies to cut corners. Costco's a huge hamburger maker, grinding 700,000 pounds a day at its plant in Tracy, California. But despite that volume, it limits the number of its meat suppliers to two or three vendors in order to scrutinize their operations. By comparison, the company that made Stephanie's burger was buying from 50 meat vendors, mixing and matching them together to make her hamburger and other hamburger. Unlike most other hamburger grinders, Costco also insists on testing the meat that it buys before it grinds it up, despite any assurances from the suppliers that they have already done this testing. In fact, we discovered by the industry's own investigation that many of the slaughterhouses caught up in the recent E. coli outbreaks were not properly testing their material, giving their customers, the grinders, a false sense of assurance. Craig Wilson, the Costco food safety chief, said it's just fine for the suppliers to say they've already tested the meat, but he says Costco will check itself, said Craig. It's incumbent upon us. If you say, Craig, this is what we've done, I should be able to go, cool, I believe you, but I'm going to check. Now, Costco has its own issues. They're struggling right now with an issue called bench trim, we can talk about if you want, where they do their own grinding in their store, and they've just realized that that can introduce pathogens into the system. But for the hamburger story, they were sort of an incredible light to sort of point to of a company, again, going beyond what others in the industry were doing. As for the glimmer of hope in the media, you know, I felt sure that my food safety stories from last year had only an outside chance of winning a prize because there are actually so many terrific reports, some from small papers as small as Bristol, Vermont Herald Courier, which won a public service award for its reporting on the mismanagement of natural gas royalties. I work for the investigative team at the New York Times, and we have about 10 reporters just in our group dedicated to doing investigative pieces. That's about three more reporters than the Bristol paper has altogether. And that's just our team. Other desks at the New York Times have their own investigative muscle. We still have the power to go after stories our newspaper is not covering and to stick with them, unencumbered by the obligation to cover a beat as our colleagues are. And this takes vast amount of resources. I spent an entire year once looking at why radiologists miss so much breast cancer, several years examining the repercussions of the war on terrorism, and now more than a year looking at food safety and nutrition. So investigative reporting, I can happily say, is still valued and supported at the Times. As for consumers, I was deluged with notes from strangers and friends after the hamburger story ran last October, and a good many of them expressed the sentiment that they would no longer view a hamburger quite the same, and that they were starting to ask questions about where their meat came from and how it was handled. And this came on top of the reaction in Washington, which included vows by the Secretary of Agriculture to step up his agency's efforts to improve the way it oversees meat, legislation to compel the kind of testing that Costco was doing. And I think that the changing view of consumers, if it is indeed changing, could be sort of the more lasting change. It certainly has in my household. My wife says it's gotten hard to go out to dinner with me. And my family friend Oma's going to find that out, I'm sure, when we go out to dinner. For all the questioning that I do of the wait staff about their food supplies and handling. But maybe more eateries will start posting this information on their menus, so I don't have to bug them. Just yesterday, I was reading in the dining section in my paper, and saw a review of a Brooklyn restaurant in which the reviewer noted that the restaurant could use a better grade of chicken, but that this would double the price. I'm not sure that's right, given that the cost of ingredients is only part of what goes into the dining bill, but I think I'll ask the editor whether it might be the right time to start thinking about adding a line in our restaurant reviews that sort of speak to the sourcing of food, whether it's organic or not, local or not, whole chuck hamburger, or the industrial blends that I wrote about. And I'm now eager to hear your thoughts and hope to answer your questions.
Thanks so much, Michael. We have lots of questions from the audience. I just first want to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss, who's discussing lapses in food safety and other issues related to food contamination. I'm going to actually ask the first question, which is, after you reported this story, particularly talking to sources inside of the meat industry, did you come to any conclusion in terms of what an acceptable level of risk is not a meat eater, I should say. There's no risk to me, no.
You know, I mean, they have a hard time putting a number on the risk, as I mentioned, but one of the basic responses from the meat industry is that this is a shared responsibility, and the consumer needs to pick up his or her share of the burden. And we thought about that. We said, okay, let's see if we can actually do that. And if you go to the Times website and plug in the words hamburger confidential, you'll see we did a little experiment in my kitchen of taking 3 pounds of hamburger, and we inoculated it with a form of E. coli that's not deadly but acts like the deadly kind. And we followed the instructions on the hamburger package. We kept it separate from other foods, or tried to. We washed our hands. We cooked the burgers. And before we did this experiment, we cleaned the kitchen, sanitized it, took swabs and swabs afterward. And, despite the kids not being around and the beer not in my hand, we managed to contaminate some of the kitchen surface. So had that been real E. coli, deadly E. coli, instead of the non-deadly that they then found in the laboratory after our demonstration, we would have screwed up and contaminated the kitchen. So I think that notion on the industry of sort of saddling consumers with, as I mentioned, this sort of very intense, if you will, sort of science project every time they cook, is a bit sort of hard to accept.
One of the questions is it safer to buy ground meat from a butcher? Do ground pork and lamb pose the same risks of E. coli as ground beef?
So the meat I wrote about is the hamburger I wrote about is derived from what are called trimmings. And trimmings are sort of the small scraps of the carcass that are cut off of larger hunks of meat or the carcass itself and thrown into big bins and then shipped to the grinders for mixing and matching, depending on sort of what the fat content they want in the hamburger. You will find some restaurants, some fast food restaurants even, I know of one in California, that uses a whole hunk of meat to grind their hamburger, usually the chuck, which is the shoulder. And there is some sense out there that that could be safer because that chuck may not be exposed to sort of cross-contamination inside the slaughterhouse. But the problem with hamburger is that, and I should back up too, that even steak can be contaminated with E. coli. It's safe for us because it's so easy to cook. You throw it on the grill, and the E. coli is on the outside of the steak. You don't have to worry about what's inside. With hamburger, it's been, if you have any E. coli salmonella, it's been mixed into the hamburger, and the challenge becomes getting that burger to the temperature internally that would kill those pathogens that are mixed in. So even if you're grinding a, you know, a top-rate piece of steak into hamburger, you still run some amount of risk that pathogens on the outside could be mixed in at your nice, friendly butcher as well.
There's several questions about how globalization has impacted the food safety system in the U.S., and I wonder if you can address that issue, but also really how the U.S. system compares to other systems in the developed world. Are there other countries that are doing this much more effectively than we are?
You know, I haven't seen that. I actually think the USDA, for what that tells us, is actually going further and beyond what many, many other countries are. Europe has an incredible sort of food safety network in hand that bars things like washing poultry in chlorine to kill pathogens. And, of course, we know about genetically modified issues. In Europe, they're quite sensitive to those. In the U.S., the USDA, you know, look, I mean, after Upton Sinclair, they started putting inspectors in slaughterhouses in a way that many, many, if not most other countries do not. And any typical large slaughterhouse could have as many as 7, 8, or 9 inspectors running around at any one time, sort of looking at the operation. But the inspectors that I met and spoke to said the line speeds are so fast and overwhelming that there's no way that they can keep up and be assured that they're spotting every last piece of contaminated meat that comes down the line. The one of the factories that contributed to the hamburger that Stephanie ate is sending half a carcass down the line every 5 seconds while workers are furiously sort of cutting it into pieces. And those inspectors, when they're shorthanded, will often make a very key sort of step optional, which is standing there when the hide is removed, which is a critical point in the operation. Globalization, you know, I think it stands to reason that the further afield you go for ingredients, whether it's spices or meat or flour, the harder it is for American food companies to monitor those companies. They often will send what are called third-party auditors to these countries to check up on the plants themselves. But we did some reporting on third-party private auditors who inspected the peanut plant in Georgia, and it turned out that they were generalists who had very little knowledge about the risks of salmonella in a peanut operation and the danger of having water and air mixing around in a peanut processing plant. So that seems to be the biggest issue. Not distance so much, because the Costco I mentioned to you pulls meat from a foreign supplier, but rather it's sort of the ability of companies to closely monitor those operations when they're further afield. The other thing happening in the food chain is that you're getting more and more middlemen, and in processed foods, you're getting more companies that specialize along the chain, the ingredient chain, of assembling ingredients. So it gets harder to trace back when there is a problem as to the actual source of the pathogen.
There's some questions here about contaminated meat in schools. What's being done now to ensure that contaminated meat doesn't end up in schools? Are there additional checks that are done?
Well, you know, Aaron, my 10-year-old, for some reason has been a vegetarian since birth. I think that's just because, you know, meat never became one of the 3 things he will tolerate eating. Will, on the other hand, who is now six, loves a good burger, and especially those school lunch burgers. And I'm actually not scared of school lunches for kind of two reasons. One, it turns out they are requiring their suppliers to do testing for pathogens sort of above and beyond what many food companies do. And then two, they cook their hamburgers into shoe leather or their chili or whatever. And those poor little kids may not be eating something you or I want to eat, but there hasn't been a pathogen outbreak involving meat in the schools that I know about for, you know, a good decade. So I don't worry about young Will.
Has the meat industry tried to threaten or intimidate you?
Meat industry is a tough industry. And they certainly, after the story ran, you know, wanted to get their message out there. And they went on talk shows with me or other people and made the point that, look, we're trying. There's no way you can get, you know, all pathogens out of the meat. I mentioned earlier sort of shared responsibility. That is sort of the tone of their message. But you know, what they struggled with the story is that, you know, the people being critical of the industry, again, as I mentioned earlier, were not consumer activists. These were meat industry insiders who felt that their own industry was not going far enough. After the spike in outbreaks with hamburger began 3 years ago, a group of meat industry insiders did their own little investigation. And as I mentioned, they were the ones that found that the slaughterhouses involved in the outbreaks were not testing for E. coli as they said they were. That's coming from the meat industry itself. So that put a bit of a damper on the meat industry's sort of ability to dismiss the concerns raised by their own members.
Are vegetarians generally better off in terms of the safety of their food, of the ingredients that they tend to eat? And you mentioned that, of course, you can have E. coli in spices and flour and all sorts of things, but in general, is there less risk to them?
You know, I think probably the answer is no. I should back up, and we mentioned the tens of millions of people who are estimated to get sick every year from a foodborne pathogen. It's an estimate because very few of those cases ever get traced to the food product. If you got sick tomorrow, you might be lucky, especially in California and budget cuts, to actually have a stool sample taken and checked. But then you're going to be very lucky if the state epidemiologist then sort of pursues the matter and plugs, you know, the bug in your system into this very infantile national database and tries to find a connection to other people getting sick in other states. Oregon has a terrific epidemiologist. Minnesota has a terrific epidemiologist. And you'll find many of the big national outbreaks are identified first in those states because they're working very, very hard. One meat industry person described it to me as the food industry sort of being down in the tall grass and this spotlight coming over, and they're lurking down there and hiding from the spotlight. And increasingly, much to their alarm, you know, they're popping up and being identified in connection with an outbreak. So it is becoming more frequent that we're identifying the sources. And indeed, I started reporting last year on peanuts because more and more it seems non-meat products were becoming contaminated with either E. coli or Salmonella. There's the peanuts, leafy greens. We have, you know, at least one sort of lettuce outbreak going on right now. And, you know, and the other issue too, and this doesn't apply, you know, just to leafy greens, but all of what we've been talking about concerns only one type of E. coli. There are other types that are nearly, four or five of them, that are nearly as harmful as the one we've been talking about, but they're not regulated because tests either don't exist or aren't being used to look for them. And increasingly, and I think the Times is doing a story this weekend about these non-0157 E. coli's that are now just sort of coming on the radar. So there's a whole bunch of other bugs out there that we're unaware of, not tracking, that could be just related to vegetables as meat.
I want to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss, who's discussing lapses in food safety and other issues related to food contamination. There's a question here about how politics affects all of this. Can you talk a little bit about how the food safety process is influenced by politics?
So one of the things that I came to realize about the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees meat, is that it has multiple missions. And one of them is to very distinctly and aggressively market U.S. meat products, both domestically and overseas. The other is food safety. And there are some people in Congress who think that's a inherent problematic conflict of interest. There are other people who are questioning why we have the Food and Drug Administration overseeing food safety and everything but meat, and the USDA overseeing food safety in meat. This came up in a story I did about frozen pot pies, which had a salmonella problem a couple of years ago, that nobody could figure out what the source was. It could have been the flour, could have been the vegetables, could have been the poultry. Eventually, the company decided to solve the problem by, you guessed it, shifting responsibility to the consumer, printing these elaborate instructions on the back on how to properly cook and take thermometer readings on their $1 frozen pot pies. But I saw in that process sort of the FDA and the USDA not working terribly smoothly together to sort of investigate those processed foods that have a combination of the two. So that's sort of happening out there. On the other hand, you have, you know, Michelle Obama, you know, fighting the anti-obesity campaign. And I do get some sense from both the FDA and the USDA that they are much more cognizant of food issues generally and food safety in particular. But again, I come back to my initial thoughts. I really think it's going to come from the bottom up and people raising concern as opposed to folks in Washington.
There are many questions from our audience about the poultry industry. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about whether or not the regulatory oversight of the poultry industry is similar to beef or something different.
I'm so glad I got a question I can't even attempt to answer. Hamburger wiped me out. And I think I did at one point suggest poultry to my editor, especially when Russia earlier this year banned American poultry exports because they're being washed in a chlorine solution to kill pathogens after the fact, when Europe and the UK and the Russians even thought it's a much better idea to try to keep the pathogens from getting in the poultry in the first place instead of trying to either irradiate it or cleanse the poultry after the fact. I have to beg off. There was this fabulous Consumer Reports test effort a few months ago, though, that found much higher than expected levels of salmonella in poultry. And as far as I know, that's withstood the test of criticism from the industry. So I would point to them as being a good guide to the issue there.
There's a few questions about how you managed to put the different elements in your stories together, particularly about Stephanie Smith. How did you find her and
so
hear about her?
We often, when we're doing sort of big stories, want to do what's called in journalism sort of the narrative style. You want to tell a story. And when I was looking at these outbreaks, kind of our natural inclination was to take not only just sort of one of the outbreaks that have been spiking in the last 3 years, but to try to drill down and look at one particular hamburger. And in this case, I was just very, very fortunate because I was able to obtain the secret, usually secret, grinding logs that the industry keeps, where they track in handwritten codes and letters everything that's going into the hamburger, and that allowed me to know precisely where the trimmings from what slaughterhouses and what quantities were used going into the hamburger that she ate. And when you're doing kind of a big narrative story like that, you're often, you know, pretending like you're writing a play, and you're looking, you know, you're looking for main characters. You're looking for a culprit, of course. You're looking for a hero. You're looking for, in this case, sort of the tragic figure bureaucrat who can't quite do what they need to do. And of course, you're looking for a victim and a face to really remind people of what sort of the human element is in this. And so, in reporting the stories, I interviewed and looked at a number of people who were sickened by E. coli. There were young children, there were middle-aged people. And Stephanie struck me as being an incredibly powerful person, not only because of sort of what happened to her and sort of the extreme end of her illness. She, after eating the burger, initially thought it was the flu, then was hospitalized within a few days and had convulsions so severe that her doctors had to put her into a coma and keep her there for 9 weeks. And when she emerged from the Mayo Clinic, even, she was paralyzed from the waist down. And, you know, the hardest thing of all, sitting, you know, with her in her home in Minnesota, was listening and watching the videos of her as, you know, an 18, 19, 20-year-old teaching children how to dance. So, you know, you have a young person, she's incredibly beautiful, having devoted her career to teaching kids how to move and dance, and sort of no longer being able to walk herself. And, you know, you need those faces. You need real people and stories in order to carry, you know, the hard, serious, you know, hitting that you're doing on the regulations and the conduct by the industry.
And what's happened to her since then? Have you been in touch with her?
So Stephanie has been into 2 or 3 main rehabilitation centers. Most of the issue with her has been sort of getting over the psychological barrier of not wanting to believe her doctors who say she'll never walk again. So when she's been going into therapy, she's wanting to get therapy that'll help her walk again. They're wanting to give therapy on, you know, how to cope with being paralyzed from the waist down. She had this amazing moment just a few weeks ago where she put on leg braces, may have had a walk or two, somebody helping her as well, and she managed to move 10 steps, and that was huge for her. And she ended that therapy and went back home just recently. And when we found out about the Pulitzer, I called her, and she was still in the rehab center. And her mom was there, and they were so thrilled. I mean, you know, in part because I told them that they had won the Pulitzer Prize. And, you know, she really saw this as an opportunity to tell her story and to open up this, you know, as I say, heretofore secret world on how hamburger is produced. So there was that little glimmer of joy in her life, certainly. She, after the prize, actually, after the story ran, she ended up suing the company that made her hamburger, and they settled just recently for, I'm sure, a substantial sum of money that at least will let her, you know, live the rest of her life comfortably.
There are a few questions from some audience members about food labels and whether or not that's a line of inquiry for you as a journalist. And you talked a little bit about how you're looking into salt content right now, but what else can we discern from food labels, and what kinds of questions as journalists, I know there are many journalist students here today, should be thinking about, what kinds of questions should we be thinking about in terms of our own reporting?
So food labels are really, really interesting. I'll start with what's not on there. So the label on the package of hamburger, and they happened to be frozen patties that Stephanie ate, her mom cooked, said, you know, for the meat portion had one word, and it was beef. And in the story, in a subsequent story, I wrote about one of the supplies, one of the ingredients that went into her hamburger was a company that specializes in taking some of the fattiest scraps from the carcass that have some of the highest exposure to E. coli, and they seek to treat the pathogens or any pathogens that might be in their product with ammonia. And as it turns out, the ammonia, which the USDA thought was a kill step in and of itself, hasn't been killing all of the E. coli. Ammonia doesn't appear on the ingredient labels, didn't appear on her hamburger, and doesn't because the USDA doesn't require that. You know, to some extent, they're really fascinating because a lot of other chemicals are on the nutrient labels, and I have been looking at them closely for sugar and fat and especially salt lately, and it's really, really interesting. I was looking at one frozen dinner-type entree, and I think it only has something like 600 calories, but it has salt listed 10 times, you know, serving various sort of functions in this packaged product. And it has other sodium compounds listed 9 times. And when our story runs in the next couple of days, we're running a graph that sort of details one of these products in detail about, you know, what each salt and or sodium compound is serving in the product. And one of the interesting things about sodium is that while the industry blames consumers for being addicted to salt and craving it, the industry itself has a huge, surprising sort of dependency on salt for texture, color, processing techniques, speed, etc. So, and a lot of these you can actually see in the label. It's fun just to take a label, you know, take one of those chemicals and just plug it into some search database or even Wikipedia and see kind of what the food industry uses are for those chemicals.
There are a few questions about mad cow disease. We sort of haven't heard about mad cow in a while. Can you tell us why? Should we still be concerned?
I can't. I have to beg off of that one either. I know I did a little reporting on the mad cow scare that we had in this country some years ago when some infected cattle, I want to say, or potentially infected, came across from Canada. But, you know, it hasn't resurfaced in this country. The thing that scares people about it is sort of the gestation period, that you can eat a piece of meat that is infected someplace in the world and not know about it for years and years. I think that's very unsettling to people, but I don't know enough about it to speak intelligently or tell you just whether or how much risk there is in that.
I just want to remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss, who's here discussing lapses in food safety and other issues related to food contamination. We have a lot of questions about, I believe some journalist students here. They're interested in your personal sense of mission as a journalist. Where does it tend to come from? Or where do you think it comes from?
You know, I'm pretty old school, and I actually, I was telling someone this morning, I actually became a reporter in large part due to a high school teacher. I went to Lowell High School here, and I'm sure I was one of the worst students there. And about the nicest thing any of the teachers ever said to me was, in fact, my journalism teacher, after I handed in a story, and she said, "You know, Michael, I think you might have a knack for this." And that was, like, incredible inspiration for me. It's not what my chemistry teacher was telling me. And, you know, the second thing that drives me is a really old-school thing, but it's this notion that, you know, really good journalism out there, you're either comforting the afflicted or afflicting the comfortable. And, you know, after I spent those 15 years sort of learning to get people's names right and facts right, I decided I wanted to be, you know, on the afflicting, the comfortable side. There's something about sort of hidden information or information that's kept hidden from the public that, you know, really gets to me. And beyond that, you know, it's sort of if I see a mission for myself or for journalists, it's to sort of level the playing field. I mean, I really believe that everybody born in this world ideally should have an equal shot at doing whatever it is they want to do. And I see the job of journalists to point out all the ways that people don't have the same chance growing up.
I wonder if you could just point out some real nuts and bolts advice or strategies for the reporters who are here and the future journalists who are here about how you go about getting some of those documents that the meat industry in this case didn't want you to get, those grinder logs, for instance. How do you cultivate those sources and get those documents?
Those sources I cultivated by going and seeing them and hanging out with them and letting them see me, talk to me. We often do something in reporting that's called sort of the pitch. And I know that when I was writing about mammograms, it took me forever to sort of, you know, talk the language of radiologists. And before, it's doctors and scientists are especially elusive and reluctant to talk to the media because we so often do sort of very quick stories on them and don't go very deeply. But if you want to do a story that goes deeper, you first have to read everything you can, learn how to pronounce their world. And when you get them on the phone, you know, you go through your 5-minute pitch. You need to sort of impress upon them that you're a serious reporter, you know, with some time to spend on the subject, and you're going to be open to their viewpoint. Fairness is sort of a huge thing in our business. You have to be willing, even and maybe especially in investigative reporting, to, at the end of the day, put yourself in the shoes of the person you're writing critically about and try to see things from their vantage point. And I think that when you have that viewpoint, I think that comes across in your questioning and in your dealing with people. And finally, you know, one of the best secrets in journalism is just simply asking people for help, whether it's, you know, the clerk at the city hall who's overwhelmed, who may or may not get you, you know, simple publicly available records. If you simply sort of stop and realize that he or she is crazed, and a simple please, you know, can you help me, goes a long way. In the hamburger stories, one of the beautiful things happening there is that a lot of these food companies thoroughly dislike each other and go to court. And that often happens after outbreaks when they start pointing fingers at each other or when one releases a new product that the other claims is usurping their claims. And so, believe it or not, without being specific, you know, a good many of the records that came my way sort of came from that sort of field where food giants were battling each other, and I'm just like standing under the tree catching the fallout.
There's some question about the editorial oversight of your story. Were there any elements of your story that your editor asked you to back off of, or did the Times at any point ask you to emphasize certain elements of the story? I guess that gets at the question of whether or not there was any influence on your...
Oh, well, thank God there's always an influence. I mean, I have two of the best editors in the business. And reporting, you know, thinking of a story, reporting it, writing it is always a give and take. Christine Kay is my most immediate editor. She is the one who saw Don Rumsfeld 18 months after the invasion of Iraq getting questioned by the National Guardsman from Tennessee, who was asking why 18 months later they were still dumpster diving for metal to tack on their unarmored Humvees. And Christine is simply sitting there a few desks from me going, Michael, what's up with that? Oh, and Rumsfeld uttered then his infamous words, which is, you know, you go to war with what you have, not with what you want, as if we were in a huge hurry. So, you know, thank God for editors like Christine Kay, who have like a sixth sense for really big ponds to go fishing in for stories. My other editor, Matt Purdy, is an amazing wordsmith. He was a columnist before he became an investigations editor and can turn sort of even my prose into something pretty. So their feedback actually is almost entirely positive. That doesn't mean we don't fight. But I would say that most of the sort of self-doubting, self-questioning comes actually from myself. And in fact, in journalism, you know, joy is one thing at discovering some key to some hidden trove that you've been looking for. But the other sort of essential ingredient to a really great story I have found is utter despair. And I worry now when I don't feel despair at some point in the process of reporting, because it means to me that maybe I haven't worked hard enough. I haven't read everything. I haven't talked to everybody. I haven't knocked on doors and gone back to knock on them again. And I haven't hit dead ends that drive you crazy. Those are the things that sort of haunt you in the reporting process, but ultimately work.
And along those lines, I think some of the younger journalists here would like to know what it takes to be an investigative journalist. You're obviously a very persistent and patient person.
You know, it's really...
Other than that, what does it take?
Oh, thanks, Sarah. So it's really pretty simple. Raise your hand and I'll talk to you. Who asked that question? Hello? All right, shy. So shyness is not a great ingredient for being a reporter. Curiosity, right? You gotta be curious, or you should be curious. You gotta kind of want to know how stuff works, and you know, you have to put yourself kind of in that frame of mind where you can go up to strangers and ask them questions about how things work. I'm not, you know, an especially gregarious person. I like to go home and be quiet, but at work, I sort of turn on that side of me. Who basically, and you know, all of your journalistic training basically teaches us how to find people who really know what's going on out there. We're not experts in anything, especially if you're a generalist like an investigative reporter. You don't have an actual beat where you do story after story and retain a certain amount of knowledge. What you do sort of retain is sort of the skill at finding really smart people who know what's going on, and then figuring out how to get them to talk to you. But after curiosity, you know, it's discipline. It's, as I mentioned, getting your basic skill sets, spelling people's names right, being fair, getting the facts straight. I mean, those are the things that will put you in a position eventually that an editor will have the kind of trust in you to do an investigative piece that they need to have. So it does take some time, but look, investigations can be really, really simple things too. I mean, when I worked at the Journal, basically every reporter there was an investigative reporter. It's simply sort of looking at something and going beyond the press conference and what people say on the surface or publicly to try to get at what you think is sort of the underlying truth. I mean, that's investigative reporting.
And then there's some practical questions here for what we can be doing in our own homes and in restaurants when we go out to eat. One question is, what type of restaurants tend to be of most concern when it comes to hygiene?
Just to hygiene.
Jack in the Box or Le Central?
Ooh, you know, I actually think, not to shock you, but I actually think Jack in the Box is probably, you know, going to have some of the highest attention to food safety issues, because they're the ones who had the young fatalities with E. coli in their hamburger back in the 80s that, in fact, led the USDA to discourage companies from producing hamburger with E. coli in it. And in a very fast food restaurant, theoretically at least, you can have systems in place that deal with cross-contamination. You can have color-coded spatulas and gloves and get the stove temperature right, you know, if your 17-year-old, you know, short waiter cook can remember to do those things. That said, sort of, you know, in terms of ingredients in the food, I increasingly sort of see restaurants in Brooklyn, parts of New York, here in San Francisco, that are starting to sort of put their sourcing on the menu. What a lot of food companies are doing, you know, you'll see a hamburger, and they'll have a sentence of description that, you know, instead of a hamburger, it's a succulent, you know, perfectly grill-roasted hamburger accompanied by da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, it's sort of meaningless stuff that just kind of gets your taste buds, your mouth watering. What I appreciate are restaurants that tell me where that meat's coming from, and, you know, naming the supplier, which doesn't mean those sort of small family cattle raisers are going to be safer. I wish there was science on that. There isn't. But it does sort of increase the accountability when you're buying at the green market or you're eating a meat that can be traced back to the supplier. If you get sick, it's going to be a lot easier to hold that supplier accountable and, you know, and get them to make the improvements to their system that sort of what's this all about. It's not eliminating E. coli. It's just kind of doing all the additional things that could be done that aren't being done now to lessen the risk.
What advice do you have for consumers who are purchasing meat? You mentioned Costco is one. Somebody wanted to know specifically about Whole Foods, if you've looked into them at all. But just more generally, when people are going out, should they be just avoiding buying ground beef altogether or,
you know,
buying it from certain sources and not others?
I mean, you're kind of talking to the wrong guy about risk-taking. I mean, I had two young boys, and I rode in a Humvee through Fallujah looking for a story. So, I mean, risk is something we all have to sort of measure ourselves, and unfortunately, again, the sort of numbers are really vague. I personally have trouble eating a hamburger that's cooked as well as the USDA tells people to, because it can dry out so fast. And I'd rather eat a steak, which can be to my, you know, medium rare preference inside. But, you know, you get that craving for a medium rare hamburger and you roll the dice. I mean, I can certainly sort of see doing that. And again, it's sort of a judgment call for all of us. I mentioned, though, the things that the meat insiders do, you know, using gloves, you know, using those bags in the grocery store. I think that's like a fabulous idea. Making sure you buy the right kind of thermometer and use it, because good cooks use thermometers all the time. It's not an impossible science project to pull off. And there are other reasons why you want to know what temperature your food is getting to. And then sort of, you know, trying to stick to those temperature numbers, I think can, you know, certainly, in the opinion of those industry insiders, can lessen the risk tremendously.
And some audience members would like to know if you have any advice for them in terms of how they can push the food industry along to make some of these changes in terms of testing. And what are the pressure points, I guess?
You know, there's legislation in Congress that would mandate the kind of testing. Some companies do a few, but very few. Clearly, sort of, you know, regulation in Washington and the USDA is a pressure point. I happen to think sort of the pricing issue at supermarkets is a big deal. And if I were wanting to push a button, I think it would be sort of at the supermarket level, talking to your grocer about where they're buying and what kind of, you know, what kind of price imposition they're putting on their suppliers. And beyond that, you all probably have more suggestions than I would have.
And then a few more questions back to the practice of journalism. Someone wants to know, how often do you start investigating a story and then just give up because it's not going the direction you feel is newsworthy, or you feel like the story just sort of falls apart?
That actually happens fairly often. We usually try to limit the time, but it's not unheard of, and it's not frowned upon to take a week or two and look at a potential story, you know, hit it hard with reporting, and then walk away for one reason or another. Sometimes, you know, sometimes we see stories that are huge and fabulous and realize we just can't do them. We just can't get to the information that we're certain exists. What you do in the business in those situations is you try to do fallback stories that buy you time. So in investigative reporting, the ideal situation, like I did last year, is you kind of take a whole pond, go fishing, and do stories along the way, hoping to find the big story that you were thinking about in the beginning. And you keep working that slowly as you go along. Sometimes those stories just have to incubate for a while. You know, maybe your key source is still working for the company or the government agency and can't talk to you, and then they retire a year later, so you go back to them then, and then it sort of opens up. So sometimes you have to be really, really patient. But yeah, we do back off of stories not infrequently when they just don't work. We're about sort of taking risks in the investigative group. And it is increasingly harder and harder to do that in newspapers.
And then I'm going to end with the ultimate question, which is, why is it called a hamburger?
A hamburger?
Did you ever answer that question in your reporting?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer. I'm so sorry. People call it ground chuck. I don't know. Except the ham sort of part, you know, might have been a descriptive part of the cow, like... We typically use chuck as opposed to a pig. Who's got iPhone? Let's Google Wikipedia. Oh, wait, we have the answer right there. Hamburg.
Hamburg, Germany? We don't know. We'll have to find that out.
See, I thought they were into Frankfurters in Hamburg, right? Right? Did they do hamburgers before us? Could be. Somebody's going to Google it here before we're gone, I'm sure.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our program, so I'm just going to thank investigative journalist Michael Moss, who recently won a Pulitzer Prize for uncovering some of the food industry's best-kept secrets. This program has been part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Sarah Varney, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you very much. Surprise, surprise, you're the hamburger.